This is 91.3 FM KUAF in Fayetteville, a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. It's 6 minutes after 12, and this is Ozarks at Large for Monday, April 22nd, 2019. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Ahead this hour, the Arkansas Department of Workforce Services is hosting an informational forum in Springdale this week with the goal of informing local businesses about the benefits of registered apprenticeship programs. We'll have that story in about 10 minutes. Coming up later this afternoon, it's NPR's All Things Considered. Today, Google and its sister companies are working hard to move artificial intelligence out of our smartphones and web browsers and into the world of medicine. What will happen when one of the world's biggest companies steps into this personal space? Today on All Things Considered. You can listen from 3 to 6 o'clock this afternoon on KUAF 91.3. Today is Earth Day, and the University of Arkansas is celebrating with a week-long series of events. Today's events include a lecture by Victoria Herman at 4:45 this afternoon in room 250 of Volwalker Hall on the U of A campus. Herman is the president and managing director of the Arctic Institute, a nonprofit organization dedicated to Arctic security research. She will discuss details of the fourth National Climate Assessment, which was released late last year. This is Ozarks at Large. Benton County will now have an alternative to its juvenile detention center, all within the same facility. Juvenile court leaders will cut the ribbon on the Alternative Placement Adolescent Center on Melissa Drive in Bentonville this afternoon at 3:30. The shelter will offer a place for youth other than jail while still allowing for out-of-home placement when the child or family needs services to go back home. Ozarks at Large's Zuzana Sitek got a look at the facility before the opening, and she has this report.
The couches set up around a TV are colorful and match the green, orange, and blue designs painted on the walls. There's also a couple of bookshelves and a foosball table. And then there's the carpet on what had once been a concrete floor.
We had our couches and chairs were the first things that came in. And with that color scheme in mind, we just kind of brainstormed what would be best and just came up with a color scheme of what would be more therapeutic than the drab, tan doors and walls and make it bright.
That's Benton County Juvenile Detention Center Director Holly Foster. She shows us around the Alternative Placement Adolescent Center. The only sign the space had once been a detention center pod are the metal doors to the 8 cells that have now been transformed into bedrooms with memory foam mattresses, pillows, bedding, and desks with drawers. But Foster says the doors, which are now covered in posters, will no longer be used to lock anyone up.
I had, 20 years of JDC experience, and it's changing that security mindset and deciding, okay, I don't have to have this camera. I don't have to have this locked door, and it was a big obstacle, I think, for myself.
And although the children who will be staying at the shelter will be in the presence of staff 24/7 and won't be able to leave the facility without permission, they will be able to move around freely. They also won't have to be subject to handcuffs, strip searches, and lice treatment upon intake. Benton County Circuit Judge Thomas Smith, who handles juvenile court cases, led the charge to use part of the detention center as a shelter.
As we started looking at all the data, a lot of the kids were getting locked up, out of necessity because there was nothing else to do with them. And the reality of it is we used to use lock up a lot more than we probably should have. We thought we were doing the right thing, but as it turns out, we are learning the best way to keep kids from staying locked up as an adult is to find ways to make a situation safe and secure without having to just jump right into locking them up.
Smith says the detention center was positioned to take on the dual role partly because they already have the staff, some of whom have a background in social work.
And our intent was to use a lot of what we'd already budgeted because it takes, to having a JDC, you're going to have certain amounts of personnel, whether you have one child or 10 kids. This was just going to be a way to have a little higher population at all times and utilize the facility the best we could and our resources, because I feel like we have very well-trained people here, people that are dedicated to kids here.
And Chief Probation Officer Drew Shover adds, the detention center also had extra space they weren't using most of the time.
To give you some background, when we started this, this facility started at a 36-bed capacity. And our average, last year, our average capacity was 5.75. And their average length of stay was about 6 days. So we had a lot of open space because we do a lot of programs within juvenile court.
Shover says they decided to make the shelter only for boys between the ages of 13 and 17 because their data showed boys made up 85% of the need for out-of-home placement.
From that point, our criteria is nonviolent kids because we've learned that a majority of kids that get in trouble are nonviolent. So you have to, you know, the way we have it set up right now is if a kid were to be detained or need an out-of-home placement and we use JDC for that, we're housing nonviolent kids with violent kids, and that's not something you want to do.
According to Shover, last year there were a little over 1,100 juvenile arrests in Benton County. Of those, 1 in 5 end up in jail.
And that is something we're trying to reduce even more because of there are adverse effects of being incarcerated. You know, historically, if you look, using incarceration as a form of rehabilitation has not been very effective.
Although the detention center has always focused on more therapeutic methods of justice since it opened in 2000, Shover says the shelter is another step away from a punitive approach.
To be candid, there is a lot of research that facilities that are out-of-home placements that are non-secure have better outcomes than those that are secure. So the type of kids that would go into JDC, we really have a baseline of two categories that is best practice would be people that are a danger to the community or people that don't show up for court.
Right now, Shover says more than 80% of the children who end up at the JDC are there for drug or alcohol offenses, property crimes, criminal trespassing, or the unauthorized use of a vehicle.
Those type of offenses require more supervision than they do being incarcerated.
That supervision will come in the form of a shelter caseworker who will work with each child and family to establish a plan they can follow well after they've been released from the facility.
We have three different types of case plans. We have an alternative to detention case plan, which means they're in and out of here within 72 hours. We have a short-term case plan, which is under 30 days, and then we have a long-term case plan. Our goal is to stay within that 7 to 14-day period to try our best, but there will be kids in here that will have to stay an extended period of time because the home is dysfunctional or they can't return to them, or we're going to get them in trade school. Just whatever the next level for them is, it may take a little bit longer.
Circuit Judge Thomas Smith says having a shelter and a detention center together in one facility makes this undertaking a first of its kind.
We have no idea what it's going to end up looking like, but we know this. We've got people that are trained and learning how to continue to evolve and best serve the kids of Benton County. And so we'll learn as we go. This is all new territory in a lot of ways.
And while the territory might be new, JDC Director Holly Foster says their goal with all the children they encounter is to make sure they get the guidance and services they need to not come back.
So they're able to get out, lead normal lives, and not be institutionalized, which can happen with kids, the same as adults. They get used to being locked up. And, you know, I have kids that, you know, started at 12 years old and I still get them at 18. And so I feel like sometimes I've raised them.
The Alternative Placement Adolescent Center took about 3 years of planning and fundraising to come together. More than half the funding came from a $211,000 grant from the Endeavor Foundation, which allowed the detention center to expand the shelter to include classroom and meeting room spaces. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Susanna Sitek.
Shelter staff ask today's ribbon-cutting attendees to bring deodorant, toothpaste, or unused boys' clothes so they can be given to future residents who might need them.
Support for 91.3 comes from Arcom Plus, providing digital and offset printing, graphic design and promotional items, and a variety of business services for jobs of all sizes. Located just off College Avenue at 461 East Township in Fayetteville, Arcom has been locally owned and operated for over 30 years. Printing NWA.com or 444-7711 for more information. KUAF is supported by Rituals Coffee and Beer Fest, hosted by Onyx Coffee Lab and Ozark Beer Company. Rituals Fest is Saturday, May 4th at the Venue 718 in downtown Rogers. Guests will be exposed to over 15 breweries and 7 roasters, mostly not distributed in Arkansas. 11 a.m. and 3 p.m. sessions will be offered. OzarkBeerCompany.com/events for tickets.
Thursday, the Arkansas Department of Workforce Services is hosting an informational forum on apprenticeship for local employers at the Jones Center in Springdale. The goal of the free event, Employers Growing Talent Through Apprenticeships, is to increase employer awareness regarding the use of registered apprenticeship as a workforce development tool. Mark McManus from the Arkansas Department of Workforce Services recently spoke with me by phone to share details of the event. He says one reason they're focusing on this topic is because the department is the recipient of 2 grants from the U.S. Department of Labor that are centered on registered apprenticeship expansion in the state.
Those 2 grants, by the way, end in the fall of 2020. And what we're tasked to do under those grants is to work with our employer partners across the state and training providers and others who are kind of stakeholders in all of this registered apprenticeship activity to assist with some of the training cost that might be associated with establishing programs. And the grants can be used to kind of, you know, start those up, incentivize employers initially, and then hopefully, you know, as employers, you know, grow in that experience and learn the value of it, that they will continue those efforts way past, you know, grant funding support. So our hope is for it to be a sustainable, you know, over a long period of time, and to be a workforce development solution that employers are looking for.
The goal of the grants, it sounds like, is to grow the number of apprenticeships offered in the state. Why is that a goal of your department? Why do you think that there should be more of these programs?
Well, I mean, we just kind of hear both anecdotally and also, you know, there are a lot of research reports that are written nationwide and some reports that we've seen from Arkansas that, you know, employers experience various challenges with filling and retaining employees. So, you know, registered apprenticeship is one option that employers need to consider to, you know, fill that talent pipeline. And really, it offers benefits to both sides of the equation. It offers benefits to the employer. It offers benefits to the job seeker. And the benefits to the employer is that they can help shape the curriculum and training to fit their particular need at their establishment. So what that culminates into is what's called a standards of apprenticeship that once that's all put together and approved by the Department of Labor, then that's a recognized program and credentialing type of system that, you know, brings with it some prestige. And then for the job seeker, they understand the career path under a registered apprenticeship program. There are systematic intervals of pay bump increases once they reach certain milestones. And at the end of the program, if they are a successful completer, they are a master in that occupation, and again, it's a recognized credential that they could take anywhere and go to work.
The upcoming forum is at the Jones Center is designed for employers. What can they expect from coming and participating in the event? How is it sort of formatted?
Well, it's going to be a half-day event starting at 8:30 in the morning with the registration, and then the meeting will really officially kick off at 9 a.m. We're going to have a lot of industry experts in the room, as well as Department of Labor official, that can answer just whatever questions that attendees may have around registered apprenticeship and maybe dispel some myths that exist out there and just get better educated. So we're going to have a really good employer panel as kind of the meat of the meeting, starting at about 9:20 or so. And those employers all represent experiences with registered apprenticeship within their organization. So, for example, we have an individual from Tyson Foods that can talk about their industrial maintenance and refrigeration registered apprenticeship program. Individual from Simmons Bank that is starting a new software developer registered apprenticeship program. UAMS is represented with a new nursing program that they're looking to get started. And then we have two other individuals that are not necessarily employers, but they have a lot to share in the registered apprenticeship space. One is Bill Yoder with the Arkansas Center for Data Sciences, who is going to be a new sponsor for a registered apprenticeship program, working with employers in a variety of IT occupations, anywhere from software developers to cyber security to data analytics. I mean, the list goes on. So he's getting well-versed in advantages to registered apprenticeship. And then the final panelist we have is Karen Brashears, who represents the National Apprenticeship Training Foundation, who has done a lot of good training work with employers in the construction trades, things like electricians, plumbers, carpentry, sheet metal workers, and the like.
You mentioned dispelling myths surrounding apprenticeship programs.
Yes.
What are some of those myths?
Well, I think probably one of the main myths that comes to mind is when you ask someone about registered apprenticeship and what they think it means, typically you'll hear answers like, well, that's for, you know, the construction trades or an electrician or plumber, that type of thing. And it is that, and it we have some strong programs in the state for the construction trades, and we're looking to expand those. But it's also much more. It can touch really all industry sectors, ranging from, you know, healthcare to manufacturing. I mean, you pick the sector, you could potentially have a registered apprenticeship program for a given occupation in that sector. So that's really what our grants are focused on, to kind of stretch out, if you will, kind of the opportunities under registered apprenticeship, and just make employers more aware that it is an option and it could be a solution for them when they're looking to train and retain talent. And really, it should be considered as part of a overall workforce development plan for a company.
Thank you so much for your time today, and good luck with the event.
Oh, thank you very much, Antoinette.
That was Mark McManus from the Arkansas Department of Workforce Services. We spoke by phone last week. The free forum, Employers Growing Talent Through Apprenticeships, is scheduled for 8:30 a.m. to noon Thursday at the Jones Center in Springdale. Registration is available at nwaemployerforum.eventbrite.com.
SONA, the Symphony of Northwest Arkansas, concludes its 64th season May 4th at Walton Arts Center. Maestro Paul Haas and SONA musicians present the season's fourth Masterworks concert. It will showcase works by Stravinsky and Tchaikovsky, featuring special guest French cellist Edgar Moreau. Tickets available at 443-5600 or sonamusic.org. A celebration of the Arkansas Winds Community Concert Band's 30th anniversary is set to take place Saturday, April 27th of 2019 at the Farmington Performing Arts Center in Farmington, Arkansas. This concert, Let's Be Frank, will feature well-known and less-known compositions performed or written by people named Frank. More information is available online at arkansaswinds.org.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Later this week, an example of existing science and emerging technology will allow people to take a walk around the Spiro Mounds in eastern Oklahoma, as the mounds might have looked centuries ago. The site, located about 10 miles west of modern-day Fort Smith, was at one time a gathering place for different Native communities. This weekend, a new virtual reality experience will create a 360-degree experience of what the Spiro Mounds might have looked like. There will be Friday events on the University of Arkansas campus and Saturday events at the Spiro Mounds. The Tesseract Center for Immersive Environments and Game Design at the University of Arkansas created the program. Late last week, Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums talked with Dave Frederick, director of the Tesseract Center, and George Sabo, the director of the Arkansas Archaeological Survey, about the project. He asked George to explain the historic significance of the Spiro Mounts.
Well, the site was an important ceremonial center for American Indians living along the Arkansas River Valley and in the western Ozark Highlands. It began to emerge as a ceremonial center about 1000 AD and reached its peak about 1250, 1300 AD, and then it maintained its importance for a couple of centuries thereafter. But the 14th and 15th centuries brought a number of stresses to American Indian communities in the Mid-South. Many communities experienced social upheavals, but more wrenching were the changes that environmental changes, and especially droughts of great intensity and duration that affected communities, and this upset agricultural economies. It also challenged leadership institutions, brought questions to religious beliefs. And so in response to this, the community organized around the Spiro Ceremonial Center, planned to host a big renewal ceremony in order to set things right, to appeal to the spirit world for assistance in rebooting the world, if you will. And they invited their neighboring communities from along the Arkansas River and across the western Ozark Highland. And so there was a great gathering of people. And in preparation for the event, the Spiroan religious leaders created a diorama in which they placed a series of sacred objects that represented both the people and the material apparatus that would be necessary for a renewal ceremony. And this became a tableau, a theater set piece for the actual ceremonial performance. And many of those artifacts are in the University of Arkansas Museum collections, and others are accessible to us from other institutions. And so we created 3D models of these objects so that Dave and the Tesseract team could create an immersive VR model of this, in which people today could experience and learn about this important event in American Indian history by interacting with the objects and by coming face to face with some elements of the ceremony.
All right, so Dave, this sounds not the easiest thing in the world to do. Let's go back a few hundred years and recreate what it might have looked like.
It is, first of all, very much a group effort, and the team has, we have four leads at Tesseract that were involved. We have probably five or six student interns that were involved. And part of the value of a project like this is bringing, because even the leads are former students and they're, you know, mid-20s, and then they're students, getting them exposed to this kind of history in a way that makes them try to recreate it in a hands-on way is a super powerful driver for them, both research-wise and identification-wise. So it's a really effective sort of learning pathway. In terms of pulling all this together, there are so many pieces that have to be assembled in VR. Some of that it's the artifacts themselves, but which are laser scanned, I think primarily with a handheld laser scanner. That produces like millions of polygons and a very heavy object to try to use in real time. And so that has to be decimated and remeshed and made playable in a real-time environment. So there's that part of it. Then there's the terrain itself. And that has to be brought into the 3D world because people are not, I mean, they're focused on a ceremonial activity, but there's the rest of the world out there with trees and hills and landscape, and that has to be recreated as well. Then there's a text, like a narrated text of the experience. So voice actors have to be assembled, and we were fortunate enough with George to have voice actors from the Caddo tribe be a major part of it. And so, and actually some of the student team went down to Conway to meet with them and do some of that recording. And again, that is really expanding the educational world of these students. So it's a lot of stuff that has to come together and play in a headset. And the thing about a VR headset is you can't have any what we would call frame drops, you know, a slow frame rate.
Okay.
Unless, like in movies, like it has to be 29, 30 frames per second. Otherwise, like people are, And in a VR headset, it's more like 80. Because people are turning side to side. It's a whole world around them.
And in these virtual reality headsets, so if I'm looking straight ahead right mm-hmm. now and I see one object, mm-hmm. but then I turn to my left, it exists even if I'm not looking it. But once I look over there, there's something to my left.
Absolutely. And all the way behind you, below you, it's 360 engulfing world, which is really different than how we're used to consuming media, which is usually with the screen in front of us. That's what has made VR such a transformation, is because it takes you out of this world and puts you in that world very much for real, in a sense of, like, your brain is like, I'm there because it's all around me.
You mentioned when you were using the laser to get mm-hmm. the items, the feel of the items, polygons?
Oh, sorry.
What are these polygons?
What's happening there is that you have, and the laser is basically bouncing a laser beam off this object and gathering the surface data. That surface data can then be made to use what we would call a mesh. And that mesh consists of tiny little surfaces called polygons. Most of them are either four-sided or three-sided, so quads or triangles. And so that count, though, like if it's really high, like you have 3 million polygons, that means you have 3 million of those little meshes. When a computer is asked to present that to you, it has to do what we call rendering, all that stuff.
And so you might have that many polygons for one item.
Yeah, so that's why we take that object and this is getting kind of technical, but that's the way it is. We take that object and we bake out what's called a normal map, which captures all that surface detail visually. And then we take the object and remove a lot of those polygons and simplify it. Then we put that normal map, which has all that visual detail, back on top. And this is a technique straight out of the game business, the video game business. So they could have surfaces that look really complicated but are in fact simple. That's what makes video games play. It's one of the key technologies.
I'm going to ask more about that. George, how did you select the items, some of the items that would be laser scanned?
Yes, I did. I've been working with a team of colleagues from several universities in Eastern North America studying this particular aspect of the Spyro site, and so I'm very familiar with all of the artifacts that comprise this ritual assemblage, and so I didn't pick every single object. I picked a selection of objects that are most central to the core elements of the ceremony and the essential features of the story that we're trying to introduce people to. And our hope is that future iterations of this project will incorporate more and more of the objects, and maybe at some point in the future we'll have the entire assemblage in there, which comprises all told of several dozen objects. But to give our listeners some sense of these objects, a few of the artifacts are carvings of figures. They're human figures, or they're human figural spirit beings, cultural heroes. And so you have a carving initially made of a soft stone that shows a human figure in a pose, perhaps a sitting pose, with all the limbs and the head and the facial features and so forth. But then that figure is adorned with earrings, headpieces, feathered robes, various other kinds of accoutrements, all of which are carved as part of the figurine. So you have a very complicated surface that is represented by this figurine, and so that's where the millions and millions and billions of polygons come in. If we're scanning this at a high resolution, we're trying to capture all of those surface details, and that in computer terms creates an exceptionally complicated file.
Dave, would he ever bring something in, or would something ever arrive and you would go, really? We're going to have to...
We know enough now. Almost every laser-scanned object that you get, if you get the heaviest, and you want to get that heavy data with all those polygons, especially from a conservation standpoint. For instance, if these objects are ever lost or damaged, you have this very accurate recording of the data for it. But that's one, conservation is one thing. Storytelling with the object in a 3D environment like a video game is a different thing.
Right, there's a narrative here,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
So you're able to laser scan the items, but you mentioned also the environment. Mm-hmm. Do you have to make some summations about what the environment was like a few centuries ago, or are you using what is there now?
We are primarily using what is there now, and fortunately, you know, the world and satellites and everything, we can pull what is called a digital elevation model of the terrain, and that's our starting point for laying out the whole setting for the VR application, is the terrain that's there now. And I don't think there's been a whole lot of change.
No, that's true. Even though we're using contemporary baselines for the environmental modeling of the site, it's not dramatically different from what existed there in the right around 1400 AD, which is when the ceremony took place.
All right. So traditional archaeology, creating a VR world, would seem on the surface to be different, but it sounds like there's something in common in the meticulousness that is required to get things right, to find out right, to excavate correctly, and then to recreate.
Right, and the recreation, and first doubling back a little bit to the environment question, the contours of the landscape are pretty consistent from then to now, but the vegetation is not. And so the site now, I think, is substantially more wooded than it was then. So we've done a lot of removal of trees and provided a much more sort of open, sort of almost grassland, plus some trees, but not nearly the amount of trees that are there now, because that seems like that's more recent. So we had to abstract some of those trees and redo the landscape, even though its geometry, its contours are pretty consistent. In terms of a video game, and that's how I think of this VR application,
sure.
And video games themselves are, you know, initially 2D, like you play with a console on a screen. The difference in VR is it wraps around the whole world of the player, and it makes it really sensitive to head movements right or left, like if they're up and down too, but right and left especially. And that means our meticulousness is removing what we can to make it play at that frame rate while retaining enough to carry the story. So we have to do those two things. And this is a thing that many archaeological teams are dealing with now, because we want to make our archaeological sites accessible to the public. And game-like experiences, and especially VR experiences, put them there in a way nothing else can. So it's really important for archaeological teams. And, you know, we work a lot with archaeologists to try to figure out how to do that.
We add some things to the model as well that makes the whole experience much more realistic for the viewer. For example, Dave's team was able to add in a lot of buildings, houses, and work platforms and grain storage facilities that existed at the site when people lived there but are no longer there, no longer visible. But we were able to identify where these structures stood and how they looked like based on the footprints buried below the ground level that archaeologists have excavated there over the past 40, 50 years.
You're both involved in disciplines that are about truth, as much truth as you can know. Is there a line with something like this that you don't want to cross?
That is a good and complex question. And actually, I think that's part of the learning experience, is putting our students right up against that line and making them think through what's a legitimate supposition or hypothesis about what was here. And you're kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't, because if it's likely this was there, it's likely this was there in quotation marks. But it's not there now. Like, we have to extrapolate or hypothesize that. And then if we go ahead and do that, well, how do you then flag to your player or your user that you've made these hypotheses to make this world come alive? Because your archaeological evidence is always like 2% or less of what was actually there.
Right.
And so you're forced to sort of tell a story and make a lot of stuff up, in a sense. But if you don't make it up, you're also misrepresenting the story, which is the beauty of archaeological sort of experiences like that and trying to tell stories. And we're fortunate in terms of the evidence that we have, because some of it consists of conch shells that are inscribed with sort of both human and sacred figures. And a series of them, about four or five of them, sort of laid side by side, tell that world renewal story. That's key, because then we can unfold that for the player. And that gives a consistency and a narrative to the story that if we didn't have those shells and we didn't know what we do about the Native American stories behind those shelves, we wouldn't be able to do the recreation.
Do you suspect, after some people see this, they'll be knocking on your door, Dave, saying, oh, I would love for you to do an immersive of this or this or this?
I think we're right on the edge of a real explosion of this kind of history, because the major game companies, I mean, they're going to make, you know, Assassin's Creed and these big canvas things. But so much history that's actually meaningful to people is their local history, which in a sense, this is both local and almost national history. But there's so many local stories that can be told in a compelling way. Imagine if we had a VR recreation of the Fayetteville Square in 1870. Like, that's very doable. And each one of those things can be, it brings people in contact with their past in an immediate way.
And you only have to look to Paris.
No kidding.
To understand why it would be important to try to capture as many images or environments as possible.
Yeah, and with a lot of World Heritage sites, there's been a fair amount of scanning. Another process called photogrammetry, which uses a set of photos around an object to create that mesh. So those laser scanning and photogrammetry are two common ways of getting those meshes. Fortunately, this has been done for a lot of World Heritage sites, and so we're starting to have this log or catalog of sites that have been captured in this way, which can be very high, heavy data, but for conservation, like looking up, like thinking of Notre Dame, well, it's so critical.
George, when did you first become familiar with the Spiro Mounds?
I became familiar with the Spiro Mounds when I moved to Northwest Arkansas in 1979. I had read about it a few years before that when I was in graduate school.
I'm going to guess in 1979 you didn't imagine that someday there would be a three-dimensional, 360-degree immersive representation.
That would have been about the farthest thing from my consciousness at that moment, yes.
So what was it like when you put on this VR headset?
It was very exciting. It was a world-changing event for me.
George Sabo is the director of the Arkansas Archaeological Survey, and Dave Frederick is the director of the Tesseract Center for Immersive Environments and Game Design at the University of Arkansas. The Spiro Mounds VR Experience, part of the Arkansas Stories Project, will be available Friday in Giffel's Auditorium from 5 to 9, and Saturday at the Spiro Mounds Native American site in Spiro, Oklahoma. All events are free and open to the public.
The Walmart Amp welcomes American soul singer, songwriter, and record producer Leon Bridges and his Good Thing Tour to the Amp in Rogers on Wednesday, May 1st. Tickets are available at amptickets.com or 443-5600.
What is Oberon? I'm Caitlin Ahrens, the Pluto Manager with the U of A Center for Space and Planetary Science, and this is Scratching the Surface. The icy giant Uranus has 27 confirmed moons. Of these, Oberon is the outermost moon and the second largest of the Uranian moon system. Oberon is just over 1,500 kilometers in diameter, so just a little bit bigger than the state of Texas. Oberon is also tidally locked to Uranus, which means having the same side of the moon always facing the icy giant. But Uranus rotates on its side, so this creates a rather extreme seasonal cycle on Oberon. Both northern and southern poles spend a period of 42 years in either complete sunlight or complete darkness. The only images we have of Oberon were from the Voyager 2 probe when it passed by in 1986. Unfortunately, only a quarter of the surface was imaged for geologic purposes. We currently know that Oberon has a very high density, meaning it's not entirely made of ice, but rather an icy, rocky mixture. The surface of Oberon also appears very red in color, possibly from space weathering. hopefully we'll have a mission specifically to look at these moons of Uranus. For more in the Center for Space and Planetary Science, or for more segments of Scratching the Surface, spacecenter.uark.edu.
Scratching the Surface with your host, Caitlin Ahrens, the Pluto Manager, is a production of 91.3 FM, KUAF Public Radio in Fayetteville. This is a listener-supported service of the University of Arkansas.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansas Songs. Songwriter Rose Marie McCoy was born April 19, 1922 in Oneida in Phillips County, Arkansas, where her parents farmed. She attended Eliza Miller High School in nearby Helena, where she lived with her grandparents. By the way, the Eliza Miller High School was begun by the businesswoman and educator Eliza Miller, who is an Arkadelphia native. Opening in 1926, it was the first high school for black students in Phillips County. Living in Helena, home to so many performers, Rose Marie McCoy learned to love the blues herself.
Here come old evil chick, always telling everybody she come from Chicago. Got Mississippi written all over.
You better stop trying to run my business.
Look who's got business.
Oh, I'll have to do what I hate to do.
Go ahead and do it. Ain't nobody scared of you.
Better stop trying to run my business.
Somebody need to run it before they run you out of town.
Oh, I'll have to do what I hate to do.
Nothing you can do. Never could do nothing.
By the time she was out of her teens, Rose Marie McCoy had moved to New York City to make it as a singer. She opened up for the likes of comedians Pigmeat Markham and Moms Mabley. The gospel vocal quartet The Dixie Ayers recorded a McCoy song in 1946, but it was the early 1950s before Rose Marie McCoy saw her first top five R&B hit, Gabin Blues by Big Maybelle Heard Here, which reached number three in 1953. Songwriting and not singing would prove to be Rose Marie McCoy's greatest gift.
When I was born, you were suffering from old age, arthritis, and loss of memory.
You know you.
Oh, Miss Know-All. You don't know nothing.
Yes, and I even know when you were born.
In school, she was so thick-headed, they put her out. She's taking up too much space.
From there, Rose Marie McCoy wrote songs recorded by Big Joe Turner, Ruth Brown, Nat King Cole, Sarah Vaughan, The Drifters, and such fellow Arkansas artists as Al Hibbler, Louis Jordan, and Little Willie John. McCoy wrote several songs with Willie John's producer, Hot Springs native Henry Glover. This includes Willie John's Uh-Uh Baby, which opened up this episode of Arkansas Songs, and If I Thought You Needed Me, heard next, and also by Little Willie John.
If I thought you needed me,
Elvis Presley's version of the Rose Marie McCoy song, Trying to Get to You, was released on Presley's 1956 debut album. It was subsequently recorded by Roy Orbison, Ricky Nelson, and later by Eric Burdon, Johnny Rivers, and Faith Hill, among others. Thank God for Elvis, McCoy would later say, although she wasn't a big fan of his version. In 1958, Presley recorded McCoy's song, I Beg of You, which hit the top 10 as the B-side of his song, Don't.
Train. I was standing at the railroad crossing, soaking wet with rain. Now I realize fortune and fame is not for me. And all these pretty stories ain't what they cooked up to be.
Brinkley native and R&B pioneer Louis Jordan recorded McCoy's If I Had Any Sense, I'd Go Back Home in the mid-1950s when his career was faltering. And while the song may have seemed autobiographical to Jordan, Rose Marie McCoy was having the same self-doubt when she wrote it.
Yeah! aching heart. He said, son, son, please don't let us part. My sweetheart stood crying, and I cried a little bit too. But I didn't have the willpower to stop. I had to do what I had to do.
But the Arkansaser needn't have worried about her musical legacy. Ike and Tina Turner's 1961 version of McCoy's song, It's Gonna Work Out Fine, was nominated for a Grammy. And McCoy continued to have hit songs through the genres and through the decades, primarily in R&B, but also in jazz, rock, gospel, and even country music. McCoy was inducted into the Arkansas Black Hall of Fame in 2008. Arlene Corsano of New Jersey wrote a biography of McCoy called Thought We Were Writing the Blues, But They Called It Rock and Roll, which was published in 2014. A giant in songwriting across the genres, Arkansaser Rosemarie McCoy died in January 2015 at the age of 92. Written by Oneida, Arkansas native Rosemarie McCoy, here in its entirety is If I Had Any Sense, I'd Go Back Home, from the 1991 original London cast recording of Five Guys Named Moe, featuring the songs of Brinkley native Louis Jordan.
I've been thinking, but I keep drinking, and I'm just about to lose my mind.
I remember the day I caught the train. I was standing at the railway crossing, something wet with rain. Fortune and fame is not for me, and all those pretty stories ain't what they're cooked up to be. Every move I made was wrong. If I had any sense, I'd go back home. Had it get hard, he said, son, oh, son, please don't let us part. My sweetheart was crying, I cried a little bit too, but I didn't have the will to stop, had to do what I had to do. Every move I made was wrong, but I had it since I go back home. My baby wrote me a letter saying, come back to my side, but I can't go back now because I've got too much pride. I'm having so much trouble, I don't know what to do, but nothing but my mother and father's friends to see me through. I stayed away too long. If I had any sense, I'd go back home.
If I had any sense, I'd go back home, from the 1991 original London cast recording of the musical Five Guys Named Moe, and written by Phillips County, Arkansas native Rosemarie McCoy. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Arkansongs is a production of Experiment Station Studios. Producer is Keith Merks. Arkansongs, since 1998.
Inside the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio, it's time for Becca Martin Brown to give us, who is the features editor to the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette, give us a bit of an idea of what's happening over the next few days.
I'm just glad we're inside.
Yeah?
Every time you say that, I'm like, well, it would be bad if we were outside.
You know, when the original concept for the Carver Center for Public Radio was drawn up, now we've been in here 9.5 years.
Holy cow.
And the original concepts were probably put together, I mean, the first brainstorms about 3 years before that, there was an idea for an outside studio. So on a nice spring or fall day, we could be outside.
Cool.
Well, you know, financial realities being what they are, that
I hate
didn't
those.
Happen. Yeah.
Yeah, but it is a cool idea. Maybe we'll get there.
Yeah.
I know a lot of people don't go see high school theater for the joy of seeing theater.
Some go to see son,
daughter,
niece,
nephew.
Kids,
you go to see the grandkids.
Right.
You go to see your friend who's directing the orchestra.
Or, yeah.
So last Monday night, I walked into rehearsal at Bentonville High School for Les Mis. Not one of my favorite shows because it's depressing.
Right.
Watching the kids was not depressing. First of all, their drama teacher is Justin Schauer, who is an amazing actor, an amazing teacher. But he's got this huge cast of kids who sound and look like professionals. All three leads are music kids. You know, you're a theater kid, you're a band kid, you're a music kid. All three leads are music kids. And they're having discussions with the band director. And oh, by the way, the orchestra is all kids. That I don't even understand, because they're talking music stuff as they're rehearsing.
Right.
They've got a beautiful set. They've had all sorts of student acting coaches and student directors, so it's all a student-driven production. And it's called the School Edition, which basically means it's a little shorter. But you have to go see these kids. It's just astonishing.
Now, what kind of sets? Because I know the Broadway and the touring version of Les Mis had these elaborate sets with
their
things that move.
Their set does not spin.
Okay.
But they do have... It's gotten to be really popular, and I've seen it a lot lately, that it's like the outdoor version of the living room set that was in theater forever. There's a second level that you can run up on. And it works really well for this show. Sam Elgis is playing Jean Valjean. He's a senior in high school. He's planning to study music and physics at either Duke or UC Berkeley.
Okay.
It just, I'm astonished. The actor who is playing the bad guy, Javert, is Utah Courtney. And he's just committed to Middle Tennessee State in the music business. It's called music production or music something. They're just, it's astonishing. And you should go see these kids and just be impressed.
Okay.
It just makes you feel happy about kids, you know, which we don't always. 7 o'clock, the 25th, 26th, and 27th, which is Thursday, Friday, Saturday. 2 o'clock on Sunday, Arend Arts Center at Bentonville High School. Tickets are $15 for adults. And you can go on the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette YouTube channel and see some of the rehearsal.
Okay.
Because, you know, I shoot video now, too. Not very well.
That's okay.
And also this week, on Wednesday, the Distinguished Speaker Series continues at Crystal Bridges with visual and performance artist Vanessa German. That's at 7 o'clock. On Friday, Khalid Hassani, author of The Kite Runner, is at the Fayetteville Public Library at 7. I think we said 7:30 the other day at 7, and it's free. Next Saturday is the Earth Theater Festival at the Botanical Garden of the Ozarks.
Right.
Arts Live Theater, doing little short plays for families from 3 to 7 o'clock. It's $10 to $15 at the gate. They're going to have food trucks. It'll be fun. The rain date is Sunday the 28th.
Good to know.
And then on Monday the 29th, one of my favorite people at the University of Arkansas, Stephen Caldwell, is leading his kids in the Lord Nelson Mass.
I am unfamiliar, completely unfamiliar with the Lord Nelson Mass.
I was a theater kid. It's a Haydn piece. He has 175 voices in the UA Collegiate Chorale, and the University Symphony Orchestra will be playing. This all happens at 7:30 at the Faulkner Performing Arts Center. It's $10 for adults.
And then I think if you're university affiliated or a senior, it's probably $5.
Yeah, it's five. And he's getting ready for a big trip with the kids to, I think, Serbia?
Mm-hmm.
We'll have a story at some point. And then you can check out yesterday's What's Up for all sorts of other things going on this week.
Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin Brown, features editor at the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette.
American rock country singer, songwriter, and actor Steve Earle and the Dukes, with special guest Junior Brown, will perform at the Auditorium in downtown Eureka Springs Friday, May 3rd at 8 p.m. A limited number of tickets are still available. 888-695-0888 or theauditorium.org. for tickets and more information.
Contributors today included Kyle Kellums and Zuzana Sitek. Additional content was provided by Caitlin Ahrens, Stephen Cook, and Pete Hartman. This is 91.3 FM KUAF in Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Arkoma, a listener-supported service of the Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be back tomorrow at noon and 7 p.m. with a brand new episode full of new stories, interviews, and information. Thanks again for listening, and enjoy the rest of your Monday.